Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the chance to talk to the two authors of Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans, and Group Interest Democrats. The book was published by Oxford University Press. The two authors are Matt Grossman and Dave Hopkins. Matt, how are you doing?
Doing very well.
And Dave?
Great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, such a pleasure, Matt. I think you are our first in the Three Timers Club on the podcast. If my memory serves me, Dave, this is your first time coming on the podcast. So I wonder maybe we can start and give you the chance to very briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm glad to be here. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Boston College. And most of my work is on political parties, elections, and other American political institutions.
Great. And Matt, since you were last here, you have had some additions to your professional life. Why don't you remind us about yourself?
I am now the director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research and still a political scientist at Michigan State University.
Yeah, wonderful. And thanks for sharing the book. It's such an interesting book and such a timely book to get us started in 2017. Before we get to the argument of the book and asymmetric politics, I wonder if we could start by talking about what symmetric politics would look like. Dave, at least in theory, what would a political system look like where parties operated in symmetry with each other?
Well, I think that a lot of the time when we talk about political parties, especially in the United States, we kind of assume that there is more symmetry than than there really is. For example, we sort of assume that the parties have similar composition, similar organization. We also tend to assume that strategically they are acting in similar ways to achieve the goal of power or influence over policy or electoral success. And so we often kind of treat the substance of what the parties stand for and the specific groups and interests they represent as different, obviously, on the left and on the right. But we sort of often assume both as academics, but also certainly journalists and pundits and other observers of American politics, assume that a lot of American politics are interchangeable. Whatever you say about the Democrats, you could just as easily say about the Republicans. Or if there's polarization going on like there is right now, we sort of often assume, sometimes explicitly state, other times implicitly suggest, that really both sides have contributed equally to it. It's played out pretty much the same in the Democratic and Republican parties over time. And when there's blame to assign, which often when we talk about political parties, we are talking about them in a negative way. There's too much partisanship. There's too much polarization. Then the blame, of course, is therefore almost by definition equally apportioned 50-50 to one side and to the other. And so the sort of vision of party symmetry, I think, is one that a lot of us have had historically in our minds. And even, as I say, political scientists, when we want to create theories of parties, when we want to create theories of politician behavior, of the way institutions like Congress operate, we sort of want to create theories that apply to both parties. You know, we only have two parties in the United States, and so there's certainly an appeal to trying to describe and analyze them as much as possible as being sort of more or less the same, just mirror images on each side of the ideological spectrum. And so part of what Matt and I have done in this book is try to question that assumption and at the very least suggest that that deserves a lot more empirical scrutiny than it's often received.
Yeah, and so as such, your argument is that we have in the U.S. a system that's far from this symmetrical pattern, that we have asymmetric politics. But that asymmetry comes in different forms. Matt, broadly speaking, would you talk a bit about how this manifests itself in ideology and then also in the arrangement of social groups?
Yeah, so Dave and I started this project with just a long list of differences we found between the parties that we thought were underappreciated. And in the end, we decided that there was really one big all-encompassing difference, that the Republican Party was more governed by a symbolic ideological movement, and the Democratic Party was more a coalition of social groups, each with particularistic policy concerns. But that doesn't mean it manifests itself in the same way everywhere. So some of the more easily identifiable places are like the media, where on the right, there is an identifiable conservative media that sells itself as such and views itself as in competition with an alternative liberal media. On the Democratic side, you really see nothing like that. You see certainly disproportionately Democratic audiences in some media organizations, but nowhere near as popular or all-encompassing as you see on the right. And you instead see just a variety of media outlets used by Democrats and more deference to the media as independent arbiters. And more trust in mainstream media among Democrats. So we see that as an important difference, but we see it as a manifestation of this larger difference between the political parties. We also see it, though, in places like Congress, where it is sometimes harder to discern. We see the Republican Party as more united by symbolic ideology, by the cause of moving public policy broadly to the right. But when it comes to actually putting those principles into practice, we see a lot of governing challenges, a lot of disagreements. On the Democratic side, we see a coalition of social groups, each with its own policy concerns, that each has a congressional leadership to speak on its behalf. So we see that in the racial coalitions of the parties, but also in specific interest groups like environmentalists. And so the Democratic Party's problem in Congress is more assembling together all of those disparate interests into one coherent agenda. And selling that agenda to the American public as a whole rather than in bits and pieces. And so we see the same differences manifest in campaigns, in the organization of the parties, and in public opinion. But those are just two examples of how it plays out in specific cases.
Yeah, and Dave, you guys write a number of times that this political system allows both parties to speak for a majority of the citizenry. In many cases, they claim that. Now, in terms of the electorate, what does public opinion tell us about how voters reflect this type of party ideology and political groupings? And maybe you could reflect a little bit on how far this goes back. Is there a long history to this, or is this a more relatively new phenomenon?
Well, it's definitely got a long history. And I think one of the things that surprised Matt and me when we wrote the book, we sort of started out with a book that was really about politics today and politics in the very recent history in our own experience. And the more we dug, and we were sort of encouraged to do so, to sort of dig back and see the roots of this asymmetry, we found a lot of evidence that it's been around a while. This is not a new phenomenon, and this is a fairly enduring pattern in American politics. And public opinion is certainly one example of that. Many people may be familiar with the finding that goes back almost 50 years now to the Free and Cantrell work in the 50s and 60s. It sort of suggests that if you're trying to characterize American public opinion as a whole, that the American public is sort of operationally liberal and ideologically or symbolically conservative, meaning that when you ask people about ideology, are you a liberal or conservative, put yourself on a spectrum from the left to the right, or do you believe government should do more things, or is it too big? Sort of at the most abstract and largest, broadest level, most American citizens sort of collectively wind up to the right of center. But on the other hand, if you ask about a lot of specific policy questions, especially domestic policy questions like Should there be more money devoted to Social Security? Should the government have a role in assisting people to gain health care? Should the government regulate private businesses more stringently for worker safety, for environmental protection, and so forth? Well, then you see a different picture of the American public where it looks a lot more left of center. And even in recent years, somewhat famously, the Tea Party movement, the members of the Tea Party movement that are supposedly so devoted on a principled level to, you know, shrinking the size of government, a lot of those specific members, in fact, think that that should not apply to Social Security benefits or Medicare benefits, which may they may be the personal beneficiaries of, right? Keep your government hands off my Medicare. So what that means strategically for the parties is that each party has an incentive to try to shift the debate in a campaign or in a battle of public opinion to its own turf. Republicans want to talk abstractions. They want to talk broad symbolic themes. They want the debate to be about, should we move things to the left or the right? Should we have conservatism or liberalism? Should we have bigger government or smaller government? Democrats want to talk specifics. They want the debate to be specifically, should we cut these entitlement programs or privatize them? Should we invest more money in education, public education? Should we help people get childcare or pay for college or, pay for other kinds of benefits? And so if we look at the way campaigns are run in this country and we look at what candidates actually say, both in their advertising and when they are in public debates and speeches, we see that the language that are used by each party reflects the strategic advantage of that party. Republicans want to talk about the big picture and Democrats want to talk about the policy specifics. And that just sort of reflects the fact that public opinion itself is somewhat ambivalent with respect to ideology, depending on sort of the level of specificity. And so because this is such a long-lasting pattern in American public opinion, it means that for a long time the parties have sort of respected that, have sort of tuned their strategy to exploit it, and have in some ways reinforced it. Right. Democrats have not spent a lot of time trying to get people to identify as liberals or to talk about what's so great about liberal ideology because they don't see that as in their interest strategically. And so that just sort of reinforces the asymmetry that we identify.
Now, Matt, even though some of these patterns have long histories, some aspects of this are relatively new, including the political media that you described before. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about some of that research that you've done in chapter 4, I think, that talks about some of these differences that show up in how political media is produced and also consumed.
Well, one thing that goes back a long history, since the 1950s, there's been a more identifiable media on the right for broadcasting in talk radio. There has been a more diversified media in the Democratic side, and it has always been the case that Republican elites have been more distrustful of the mainstream media than Democratic elites. But what the Republican Party and the conservative movement accomplished since the 1960s is to sow the distrust that they had in the mainstream media to the wider conservative electorate. And alongside to convince that electorate to rely on explicitly conservative media outlets instead of trusting the mainstream media. So there was always an elite distrust, but it was moved to the public, the conservative side of the public. But in addition to that, while that occurred, obviously the conservative media got stronger with the rise of Rush Limbaugh in the 1990s and Fox News Channel in the 2000s, so that now you really do have a large section of the Republican electorate that relies overwhelmingly on explicitly conservative media. We tell in the chapter a similar story of the conservative movement's reaction to academia. conservative elites were always also distrustful of people within universities being the experts to set about identifying public problems and evaluating potential policy solutions. But they were, again, able to convince the Republican electorate as a whole to be more skeptical of the role of experts, particularly in academia, and alongside that, to build an alternative community of experts in the think tank world that similarly held a comprehensive and identifiable conservative ideology, so that they could say, well, you have your experts, but we have our experts, and they believe different things and have accumulated different types of evidence. So in both of those cases, there was a long history, but the conservative movement achieved something real in translating its skepticism of the liberal establishment to convince its public supporters in a self-reinforcing way that they needed to rely on explicitly conservative alternatives.
Now, Dave, this all makes total sense to me. But seems like this has to be adjusted in some ways for Donald Trump. I wonder if you could fit his campaign and his looming presidency into this story. Has he followed, does he reinforce the story that you tell in this, or does he open up some new and unusual patterns? Fit Donald Trump into this.
Sure. Well, the main way that Trump is sort of different from a lot of previous Republicans is that his campaign rhetoric did not really center around anti-big government themes to the same degree that previous Republicans have done. And Trump, of course, is not a sort of born and bred member of the conservative movement the way that many previous Republican candidates have been. And so Trump, in some ways, to his advantage, kind of sidestepped questions about whether he wanted to privatize Social Security, or whether he wanted to cut Medicare, or these other sorts of economic issues that Democrats often criticize Republicans for, and that Obama criticized Romney for 4 years ago. But in a lot of other ways, Trump isn't so different as he might first appear. He certainly campaigned a lot more on broad symbolic themes than he did policy specifics. And that's very much consistent with previous Republicans. It's just that his broad symbolic themes were not necessarily so much about individual liberty and the threat of the state as they were a sort of aggressive American nationalism and kind of ethnocentrism and a symbolic nostalgic appeal to make America great again, right? To return to some sort of mythologized past in American politics. It's also the case that Trump, to the extent that we can see what kind of administration he's putting together, is putting together a pretty conservative administration. I mean, if you look at his appointees, even starting with his vice presidential selection, Mike Pence, and looking at the other people who are staffing his cabinet, we don't see a lot of moderates in there. We don't see a lot of people with lots of sort of neutral policy expertise and credentials there. We see a lot of people who, seem to be coming from non-governmental experience, or they seem to come from the military. And there's not a lot of emphasis placed on, prizing the smooth functioning of the bureaucracy as sort of the primary goal of government. And so, if we sort of look at what Trump is doing rather than what he's saying, the picture seems to be of a presidency that may be just as conservative, if not more so, than the previous Republican president, George W. Bush. And if you look at the Republican leadership in Congress, which, of course, is also going to have a hand in setting policy for the next 4 years, similarly, at least we see a very conservative leadership there as well. And so Trump, in several kind of superficial ways, is a break with with the pattern, but we don't really think he's so much of a different character as some people are suggesting. And even since the election, I think you've seen much less of Trump distinguishing himself from the rest of the Republican Party and much more sort of going along with a lot of what the Republican Party and the conservative movement would already sort of expect or ask for in a presidential administration.
And Matt, what about Trump's relationship to organized groups and the social groups that in the past have seemed to be de-emphasized on the Republican side? Is the pattern the same there?
The campaign rhetoric that Trump used certainly made more explicit references to social groups than most prior Republican campaigns. Interestingly, the advertising data from lower level elections did not show any of the same shifts. So it seemed to be Trump alone making some shifts in that direction. And surprisingly, the greater shift in that respect was on the Democratic side rather than on the Republican side. Again, not one that was really reflected in congressional or other kinds of advertising on the Democratic side. But Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign was still overwhelmingly about groups, but a bigger shift away from class-based conceptualizations and toward racial groups and other kinds of social groups. So both presidential campaigns shifted their group rhetoric fairly substantially from previous presidential campaigns, but not in ways that were reflected in the wider political parties. In terms of his relationship with those groups in his presidency, I haven't seen a lot of sign that you'll see any kind of a Democratic-style governing system where we bring in, for example, like on the Obamacare negotiations, the Democrats brought in, you know, all 10 sectors of interest groups to work together to write the bill, to satisfy different interests, to satisfy constituency groups in Congress, like the Congressional Black Caucus and the pro-life Democrats. We haven't really seen any sign that that kind of governing style will be taken up by Trump, where he'll bring in different kinds of groups within the Republican coalition with organized leadership speaking on behalf of different constituencies to try to meld together legislation. So far, just more group rhetoric in the campaign from Trump.
Yeah. Again, the title of the book, Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Matt Grossman, David Hopkins are the two authors, and Oxford University Press is the publisher. Thank you guys so much for your time today.
It was a pleasure, Heath. Thanks for having us.